What I'd like to do here today is to provide a brief assessment of where I think we are in the war on terror. Now, others, I think previous speakers, have covered that better than I can. But really to set the backdrop for my remarks on strategies and capabilities, on which I'll focus the bulk of my time, which really gets to the essence of what I think we need to do to deal with this current and future environment. And I promise I'll leave ample time for questions and discussion. Now, to set the stage for my remarks and the discussion to follow, just to put everything on the table, I want to give you a little sense of what my day job is at the Pentagon. Is got this awful name, Assistant Secretary of Defense, that's the good part, but Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict, and Interdependent Capabilities, which some say means Special Operations Forces and lots of other stuff. If you pronounce it an acronym, as the Pentagon is wont to do, Solik Ick, it sounds even worse than when you spell it out. But there you have it. Several previous jobs, about four, were combined into this or expanded. It has lots of diverse duties, but basically it divides into two parts: oversight of from a senior civilian policy perspective, our operations overseas, and then our future military operational capabilities. In those two broad portfolio areas, I divide my time about 80% these days on operations and about 20% on capabilities. Most of these operations involve sensitive activities that I can't talk about. I'll try to talk in general terms here today. On the oversight of operational capabilities, that's really the special ops plus the interdependent capabilities. That ranges from our nuclear forces, our conventional long-range strike forces, our space, our cyber, our missile defense, our conventional forces, and of course our special operations forces. So it gives you a sense of what I'm prepared to talk about if those are of interest to you. I'd like to start now with the topic of my prepared remarks, which is building the global counterterrorism network. And before I do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about where we've been since the 9/11 attacks. First point I'd like to make, of course, is obvious to many of you, but America didn't choose the war on terror, however it's named. Al-Qaeda targeted America. They had a strategic debate, as I think my intelligence colleagues have told you about near and far enemy, of what's the best way to catalyze a broad uprising within the Muslim world, and then to change the international balance of power. The problem pre-9/11 wasn't just the Afghanistan sanctuary, although that was a very, very severe problem, but terrorist groups with global reach, of course, the European cells and others, but also East Africa, Arabian Peninsula, Southeast Asia, a global problem that exploited globalization. After the 9/11 attacks and Operation Enduring Freedom, or the war in Afghanistan, we practiced a revolutionary form of unconventional warfare, combining our most advanced weaponry and surveillance equipment with our special operations capability to eliminate the Al-Qaeda and Taliban-hosted sanctuary in short order. Had a number of early successes in the clandestine war, principally in Pakistan, with some of the Al-Qaeda against the Al-Qaeda fleeing senior leadership. And then the war in Iraq, I think, is properly strategically seen as a fundamental struggle between ourselves and our partners and our adversaries to deliver a decisive blow in this war, in both cases. One, to bring about a change that would catalyze further change, I think the perspective on our side, and then, of course, trying to exploit the opportunity on Al-Qaeda and its affiliate side as well to foster their strategy. I'd like to shift now to the continued threat from the Al-Qaeda-associated movement, and again, some of this ground has been covered. I just want to put my personal perspective on it. We've had some notable successes over the past 7 years, and some of these have been gradual and incremental, but still quite significant. In Southeast Asia, particularly the Philippines, but elsewhere, in an area we describe as the terrorist transit triangle that includes a lot of insular Southeast Asia. We've had considerable success against Abu Sayyaf and other groups and Jamaa Islamiya. That doesn't mean they're finished off, but we've had substantial success. The group that called itself Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula was doing rather well until 2003, particularly in Saudi Arabia. And then the tide really has turned against them. And over the past 4 years, there have been considerable successes against that group and its offshoots to change the balance there rather significantly. More recently, there's been a significant balance change in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is now a whisper of what it used to be. It doesn't mean that it's gone away, but its capabilities are a lot less on many metrics than it was a couple of years ago. Director Hayden, CIA Director Hayden, has even mentioned that as he looks around the world in open testimony, that the reconstituted sanctuary in the tribal areas in Pakistan, or federally administered tribal areas and adjacent areas, Al-Qaeda senior leadership is on its heels as well. Some like to cite a core metric that there haven't been any homeland attacks since September 11, 2001. That doesn't mean there haven't been plots, as I think the National Intelligence Officer recently discussed in talking about the national intelligence estimate of a year ago and follow on. Fortunately, these plots have been disrupted, but the threat remains fairly significant. And Al-Qaeda has also demonstrated a capability to regenerate. When they get set back, they're able to replace some losses. Not necessarily to their previous level, not necessarily to the same skill in some individuals, but they do have a regeneration capability. Looking around then where I think we are right now, the Afghanistan insurgency has gotten significantly more intense the past 2 years. From a very, very low base, but is a growing challenge there. Situation in Iraq has gotten much better, but as General Petraeus and others have pointed out, the durability of the change that we've seen, the dramatic change that we've seen in Iraq in the past year, is still a bit difficult to measure of just how fragile that may be. But the signs are certainly pointing in the right direction. The tribal areas of Western Pakistan remain the most significant strategic threat globally. And within a region, I might add, a threat to Pakistan, a threat to Afghanistan, and a threat to the United States and Europe and elsewhere. The situation in the Horn of Africa remains challenging. Somalia, across the Red Sea, and Yemen. In the Levant, it's challenging, in Lebanon, and in the Maghreb, particularly in Algeria. We've had a dip down and now a rise up in violence over the past year. And of course, Algeria's had enormous conflict the past two decades. These are areas that Al-Qaeda targets strategically and with varying degrees of success, but they remain concerned to it. Looking around the world, looking at some of these areas where we've had greater successes and others where we still face challenges, the point I would want to leave you with is, one, the threat remains global. Wherever it emanates from, it still takes advantage of globalization, both in a diaspora sense, but also in mobility and internet and things like that. And the threats do not just emanate out of traditional Muslim lands, but can emanate out of the UK, other parts of Western Europe, etc. If you looked at the number of threats over the past decade, you would see as many or more coming out of Europe as the greater Middle East. Al-Qaeda's goals remain to catalyze an Islamist insurgency, to break up and or prevent the formation of international coalitions arrayed against it, to exhaust and expel the West from Muslim lands, to overthrow apostate or what they consider illegitimate states, and to establish a new caliphate, weaken the West, and transform the international balance of power to favor this new caliphate. Rather large ambitions, to say the least. Now, the long-term strategic challenge I believe we face in the war on terror is what we described in our 2006 Quadrennial Defense Review. This is a major strategic review that Congress has mandated every 4 years to look at our strategies, our modernization programs, our force structures, and our global postures. And that is the challenge of dealing with this global threat, of winning what we call steady state, or through continuous operations, albeit small and in a lot of cases low visibility operations, in scores of countries with which the U.S. is not at war. So rather than large combat zones, a couple of large combat zones as we see today, the fundamental long-term strategic problem in our view, and this doesn't mean this is the only aspect of the war on terror, is really this problem of how do I deal with a threat that is spread across the globe, across, say, some 60 countries at any one time and multiple continents. Dealing with this problem requires, again, looking back at the Quadrennial Defense Review and other documents, fundamentally what we describe as an indirect approach. The indirect approach contrasting through how we apply power, whether we apply it principally through ourselves as an instrument or through others that we enable in some way. This doesn't necessarily have anything to say about the kind of power that's applied, that one is more forceful or less forceful than the other. It's just who is the primary instrument. Are we advising, training, enabling, doing something else? Are we the smaller forces in number relative to someone else's larger forces that we are trying to amplify? Or are we the main force? And a clandestine approach, because much of this war is a war in the shadows and fundamentally an intelligence war. When you operationalize that basic idea of an indirect supplemented by a clandestine approach, and there's still room for direct approaches as well, that means we do most of this work by, with, and through our partners. We try to mobilize as many partners as we can around the world in this common cause. And as I mentioned, that principally means training and advising and assist and enabling them, but it can mean in combat or not in combat, depending on the circumstances in a particular country. I mentioned the primacy of intelligence. There's not much I can say about some of our intelligence disciplines in this forum, but they are absolutely essential. They've made great progress in their capabilities during this decade. And then one particular discipline, which I have some familiarity with, which is the most difficult to talk about, the area of covert action is absolutely central. It was a decisive instrument of the Cold War. It remains a critical instrument to the war on terror. And I'll just leave that at that. Another aspect of the strategy, which has existed since the 9/11 attacks, is the imperative of denying our adversaries any sanctuary. Many of you may remember in the 1980s, a lot of the terrorism game was trying to catch terrorists before they could go to some sanctuary and then come out to attack again. The greater lethality of terrorism today mandates that we do not give them that sanctuary, but we also try to deny them resources as they operate globally on the world, whether those resources are financial resources or information resources, and bringing multiple elements of power to bear on this network, both where they seek respite, but also where they seek strength. Because our most dangerous threat is the nexus between terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, counterproliferation efforts become very, very important, both to stop those activities at their source, but also to have the ability to detect them if they were in transit and then stop them before they reach their intended destinations. Now, this strategy, of course, since it's principally indirect and involves working principally through others, must of course be enabled by diplomacy and information operations, both of the less visible, I'll say, and more visible variety are central to the conflict. And I've already talked about the supporting elements of financial, law enforcement, and development assistance, which all must be integrated to bring about this effect. But what the purpose of my talk today is really to talk about what I believe is will prove to be the decisive operational instrument of this war, and that is something we describe as a global counterterrorism network. First sort of general principle is that it takes a network to defeat a network. Are the adversaries that we confront range from fairly organized networks to what someone might describe as franchises that have marriages of convenience or some other relationship. But because they take advantage of globalization and because they have these greater or lesser degrees of links, defeating the network becomes very, very important, and defeating it at multiple nodes becomes critically important. Now, this global counterterrorism network, the capabilities and capacities and posture and policies that comprise it, didn't just arise post 9/11. They're built on capabilities that we had before. The expansion of some of these capabilities started right after the 9/11 attacks. Others, significant changes have occurred more recently after the 2006 Quadrennial Defense Review. And the strategy for employing these capabilities, of course, has continued to evolve as threats have changed and as of our capabilities have evolved as well. In some cases, you know, it's a question of we started on a path to build certain capabilities and capacities and authorities and policies to be able to use them before we knew exactly how all the elements will fit together. It's often the way it works in the security business, and then you add pieces to it and refine your concepts and strategies, and over time, you know, you hopefully get the right combination. The core operational elements of our network, this global counterterrorism network, is really our intelligence community writ large and all the capabilities that it brings to bear. And some of that, of course, can be delivered remotely, and some of it needs to be delivered locally. But one important element in particular of the intelligence community is the National Clandestine Service of the Central Intelligence Agency, of which I'm a former member, that comprises a lot of the nodes of the network, supplemented in a very large way by our special operations forces, but most importantly, by the security forces of our many partners around the world, security forces of varying types. And so those are sort of the three legs of the stool, if you will, sort of the broad intelligence apparatus that supports the network, the operational aspects of our intelligence community, particularly the National Clandestine Service, that comprises an operational backbone of this network, and then our missions overseas, of course, which bring together all the other elements to bear in that, not just intelligence and security, but those others that I talked to, and of course, as I mentioned, the diplomacy to bring in the foreign partners. The key military component is our special operations forces, but then, as I mentioned, our foreign partners are really the core element, or the sinew, as I've described it. The purpose of this network is to create a persistent, ubiquitous presence against an adversary's network or to prevent them from emerging in various areas and essentially to smother them over a very protracted period of time until that movement is suffocated. Now, this is just from an operational perspective, not from the broader informational and developmental assistance and other effects that one would have. But they work in parallel, obviously, and in harmony. Now, this is, in my view, how we expect to win this war over the long time. This is the instrument, or at least the core operational instrument. It will occur very gradually over a long period of time. Some have called this the long war for good reason. We have no idea how long is. But like a lot of intelligence competitions, it's a protracted competition, but it's a war largely in the shadows and through others or conducted clandestinely. that doesn't mean that there couldn't be spikes from various times, either of our choosing or our adversary's choosing. If we have state sponsors, for example, such as the Taliban-Al-Qaeda marriage that existed in Afghanistan prior to the 9/11 attacks, we might choose to deal with that state sponsor through precision fires, assisted unconventional warfare, as we did then, or some other means, or more conventional means. We also have to be prepared, however, for success on the adversary's part, where we could have a critical state failure. Instability in some key state, and I'll let your imaginations work there, that we have to shore up. And this again, is why the department has expanded its focus substantially on irregular warfare and the counterinsurgency side, both the steady state working through others, but also the large-scale counterinsurgency, where we may use large numbers of our general purpose forces, as we are currently in Iraq, to do stability operations and counterinsurgency, remain a real critical capability in our arsenal. And this is, again, where you get into the more direct approach versus the indirect approach. Now I'd like to talk about some of the components of this network and focus principally on our special operations forces. Special Operations Forces and our Special Operations Command down in Tampa has been really one of the growth stocks of the Department of Defense during this decade. By the end of the decade, or probably early in the next decade, our Special Operations Forces will essentially be almost twice as large as they were at the beginning of the decade. They'll reach about the mid-60,000 in terms of total manpower. There will have been more than a doubling of Special Operations Command's budget. There will be a lot more, there already is, but there will be a lot more flag officers and general officers who come from a special operations background among our senior leadership. If you look at the operational core of our Special Operations Forces and focus on the ground operators, there's some 15,000 or so of those. Give or take how you count them. These range from our Army Special Forces or our Green Berets, our Rangers, our SEALs, some classified units we have, and we've recently added a Marine Corps Special Operations Command to this arsenal as well. In addition to adding the Marine component, each of these elements since 2006 and out to about 2012 or 13 has been increasing their capacity as well as their capabilities, but their capacity by a third. This is the largest growth in Special Operations Force history. By the time we're done with that, there will still be some things, some gaps we need to fix undoubtedly, but we will have the elements in place for what we believe is the Special Operations component of the Global War on Terrorism. Special Operations Forces, I think through this decade and into the next one, have been and will remain a decisive strategic instrument. We used to, when trying to answer the question about what made Special Operations Forces special, we liked to say that, well, it was because of this tactical virtuosity or the skill of the individual operator that they were trained to such a high level. My counterpart, Admiral Olson, and I now like to talk about it, that it really is the strategic employment or impact that these forces cumulatively have in this broad war that we find ourselves in, that really is what's making them special. It's not so much the virtuosity, though that remains and is on display almost every day overseas. There's been a very significant, about a 40-50% increase in operational tempo and, of course, more intense in terms of the action since the 9/11 attacks. On any given day that we wake up, our Special Operations Forces are in some 60 countries around the world, but more than 80% or so of those right now are concentrated in the Greater Middle East or the United States Central Command area of responsibility, the bulk of those, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is one of the reasons why we're expanding our force rather significantly so we can get broader global coverage. Our Special Operations Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, but with applicability some other areas of the world, of the world have really invented a new way of war, and I'd like to talk about that, some of the key elements in a little bit of detail. And that is waging the war on terror from an operational perspective, meaning a campaign or protracted perspective, by waging war on terrorists, on key leaders, on key facilitators, through a proactive approach and through a sustained approach to counterterrorism. Again, our counterterrorism operations have changed from what we knew pre-9/11, where they would tend to be more isolated operations and in response to something, and now, of course, they're very sustained, proactive, and almost everything has changed about them. Not that we can't still do the old thing. The elements of this new way of war are really changes in the concepts, the way we do these. We now have intelligence-driven operations, that you actually do operations to generate intelligence to then lead to more operations, and the cumulative effect of those operations allow you to take down a network over time. And so if you look at the tempo over time in Iraq, whether it's a province like Anbar, where we've had we had very, very difficult time and then great success, or you look at the country as a whole against Al-Qaeda in Iraq or the special groups, you see this idea applied. We call it F3EA, which is find, fix, finish, exploit, and analyze. I would emphasize there's a lot of intelligence in those things. And the finish part is something that's very dramatic and we're very good at, but it's all the other parts of that alphabet soup that really matter that allow you to do the finishing. New tactics, techniques, and procedures of how we go about doing these operations have changed, how we enter buildings, et cetera, to deal with this very difficult threat. Our special operations forces in this sustained war on terrorism have been pioneers in the exploitation of new technology, applying it to this cycle. Principally unmanned aerial vehicles, but what we describe as persistence, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or more colloquially, the unblinking eye. And that, again, has made enormous difference. It's why it's Secretary Gates' top priority. He stood up a task force to bring more intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance into the department so we could get them in the hands of our troops. And again, our special operations forces have really pioneered these techniques, and it's expanded to the broader force. And then the third leg of this, or the third portion of it, is more than leg, is relationships. And that is, I mentioned the intelligence operations link, but really the interagency link relationships, the close operational collaborations that have been formed in this war, where we have partners from across the interagency working every day together on the same problem, has produced really dramatic results and allowed us to move at the speed of war where we couldn't before. Decision-making has now matched the operational requirements. And then, perhaps not for the faint of heart, but the fourth component is relentlessness. And sometimes it's hard to measure how well you're doing, but if you look at results over time, what looked like a very difficult fight, in some cases led to, we have taken down a network pretty substantially, but you wouldn't do that without a strong stomach and without operations day after day and doing intelligence and ops to generate more intelligence and then taking apart the network. And that relentlessness is a key, really key component. Okay. I mentioned there's been dramatic increases in our special operations forces to date. There's more ahead that will take the next administration to play out. But there's still some gaps that we have another strategic review coming up with the beginning of the administration that right now clearly need to be addressed and weren't addressed in the last one. And that is basically, again, in these areas of enablers of you've got to be able to find the place you want to go. So intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, we're working as hard as we can on that. We may be getting close to having the problem more or less under control, but perhaps more needs to be done. We clearly have more that we need to do in getting more resources out of our existing and perhaps additional rotary ring airlift. If you can't get to the fight, Even if you do a good job in your local neighborhood, it festers in lots of other places. And that's fundamentally one of the problems we have in Afghanistan. And again, if you're going to do this principally with partners, you've got to be able to move them too. I mean, they're really your muscle. So you may be enabling them with intelligence. You may be helping them plan and train them and go with them. You got to be able to move them. And so that's a shortfall. And then there's areas on the sort of the non-muscle side in civil affairs and in psychological operations that are, these forces are in enormous demand. They're on less than a one-to-one deployment cycle, and they pay enormous dividends. In several countries around the world, we have small civil affairs teams that work with the Agency for International Development, and the bang this country gets for the buck out of four Americans is truly astonishing, and the work they do in some very remote places. You know, helping people dig wells or establish schools or a range of things. And we found we need more of them. We've actually, I think, quadrupled our capacity in the past 4 years, and it's not enough. Now, we started from a very low base, but we probably need to double it again or more before we're done. And then in keeping with the idea of no sanctuaries, we need to make sure we continue our capability and our investments to make sure we can clandestinely infiltrate hostile countries that might harbor terrorists or denied areas, as we describe it more generically. As we look out over time, as we move into a more information-intensive biometric world, that will pose challenges for operating in these environments, and we'll have to exploit that both ways, both to figure out how to counter it as well as exploited for our own benefit. It's always a struggle to make sure we have the foreign language expertise we need in the force or foreign-born operators, but we're taking steps toward that. We may need some additional organizational arrangements. I think greater integration, building on our wartime lessons with intelligence community and others, may be useful, and we're looking at some alternative command arrangements within the Department of Defense. As I mentioned, we're seeing more mainstreaming of Special Operations Forces senior leaders into senior leadership positions. I think that trend will continue, and I think it's important. Now I'd like to make a few brief comments about the intelligence component of the global counterterrorism network, the intelligence community writ large, and the National Clandestine Service. And again, I can't really say much about this area in a public forum. But this is really, if Special Operations Forces has been a major growth stock in the Department of Defense, and there have been a number of growth stocks, this is another big one across the U.S. government since the 9/11 attacks. Again, without getting into details about the magnitude, its capacities and capabilities have grown pretty substantially. Central Intelligence Agency, of which I'm an alum, got the name Central for variety of reasons in a community to be sort of the central focal point serving the president. But it let me tell you, it's central in terms of a global counterterrorism network, too. And, you know, you hear a lot of talk sometimes by pundits and others saying how CIA is broken and it needs to be reborn as another Office of Strategic Services. Nothing could be farther from the truth in my mind. While all organizations populated by humans have human problems, they literally are central. The intelligence community gives us our global reach and allows us, as I mentioned, to move at the speed of war, intelligence enabling that. And since it's an intelligence-led war, it's couldn't do it without them. Finally, a comment about our international partners. Again, this ranges from across security forces. This can be internal security, intelligence forces, or intelligence services, special operations forces, general purpose forces, or conventional forces of our partner nations. We partner with all of them. To bring about the effects we need within specific countries, within sub-regions, across regions, and then globally. It is absolutely impossible to win without them. So So again, you know, there's a lot of debates a lot of times about how we do the big wars and whether we're the dominant partner in the direct approach with junior partners or not. You know, each war looks a little different. For the global war on terrorism across multiple countries, they are the dominant partner. I mean, we may be the big enabler, but they're the dominant partner, and there's just no other way to say that. They're the sinew of the global counterterrorism network, and we're trying to jointly establish security, and it's impossible to do it without them. So I'd like to conclude, and then I'll open it up for questions and discussion, talking about giving you sort of the concept and strategy of the global counterterrorism network, how it sort of would be applied against this array of threats we see, and then its key operational components, and then supporting components. Where are we in terms of actually building it? And as I mentioned, some of these capabilities, capacities, and relationships have been predate 9/11, the September 11th attacks. Some were significantly expanded since the 9/11 attacks and take more than a decade to reach their projected end state. Others will take through the end of the next administration. But the pieces are basically coming into place now, that we're able to build a more, as we get more experience and we get more capability and capacity, to develop a far more capable network of these elements. There will likely be a need for more integration as we go forward, particularly again when this, if this fundamental problem is correct, that it's countries with which we're not at war, that we have to operate in simultaneously. And then, of course, partner development and partner alignment in terms of goals and aspirations remains the critical problem, which is why, again, I just want to can't emphasize diplomacy enough. But rest assured, we're on the way to building this network, and it is really a critical instrument to keeping America safe through the next decade and beyond. With that, I'd like to take your questions.